Even a detailed survey with accurate sonar maps, video footage, and ground-penetrating sonar will reveal very little to anyone. The real work was deep under the seafloor in the tunnels carved out by your machines, too deep for standard sonar to reveal. At best, the Americans will have discovered a subsurface mining operation that was destroyed by some minor geologic activity, and the wreckage of an aquatic habitat, half buried in a canyon. They will have learned nothing about the nature of the operation or the golden adamant. And by the time they do, we'll be in control of the Japanese government, and you and your agents will be free to mine all the golden adamant on Hokkaido, providing you can actually find it. Han was put on the defensive. We are very close, he insisted. I will soon be in possession of the ancient swords and Masamune's journal, which tells of their forging. Those items will lead us directly to the mine from which Masamune obtained the alloy in the first place. But none of that will do any good if the Numa agents in Shanghai or their associates here expose us. Wen fell quiet for a moment, like he often did when they were playing Go. Han took the moment to take another drink. Finally, the old man spoke again. You say Austin came to you. He asked for my help in the exploration. A bold stroke, Wen said. He must have been trying to shake you. I assure you, he learned nothing. Still, there's a great deal to be admired in the way he plays the game, and much to learn. Such as? Remember the first lesson of the board, Wen told him. Your greatest opportunities occur when your opponent overextends himself. He becomes easy to cut off. Austin's aggressiveness makes him vulnerable. I believe we can use his arrogance against him. How? We have planned to move against the Japanese Prime Minister using vaguely American assets. Is that not correct? We have captured two servicemen, Han insisted. The American government believes they've gone AWOL. Get rid of them, Wen said. Their dereliction of duty will make their actions too questionable. In their place, we will use others with more impressive resumes. You mean... I do, Wen said. How much better for us if a well-known American agent who once worked for the CIA was seen killing the Japanese Prime Minister as he signed a friendship agreement with China? It would infuriate the Japanese public. It would seal the realignment like nothing else. Han felt a wave of energy wash over him, and he began to grin. You're correct, as always, Lao Shu. I apologize for not seeing the opportunity sooner. Austin has played directly into our hands. Chapter 31 Shanghai. The howling grind of a large engine cut off all conversation as the double-decker bus, with its top removed, accelerated along a crowded road in Shanghai. Modern buildings passed by on either side, while sharply dressed shoppers walked the streets with bags of brand-name merchandise in their hands. Up ahead, a construction crew worked on the outside lane, slowing traffic to a crawl. Paul Trout stood on the lower level of the bus, his arm raised high, his hand gripping a strap that hung from the ceiling. Gamay sat in the window seat next to him. After making their way out of the warehouse, they'd bought new shoes and new clothes while formulating a plan to get themselves to the consulate unseen. The answer came to Paul in a brochure for Shanghai Tours Limited. 2 hours later, he and Gamay boarded the brightly painted bus and began a slow jaunt around the city. They rode in relative comfort, surrounded by other tourists, many of whom were European or American. It helped them to blend in, instead of sticking out like a sore thumb. The route took them past historic temples, palatial government structures, and even a sprawling concrete building that had once housed the largest slaughterhouse in the world. It was now renovated and filled with upscale shops and restaurants, including several that offered vegan or vegetarian fare. They stopped briefly at the Oriental Pearl Tower, the most famous landmark in Shanghai, a bundle of spheres and huge tubular supports that rose 1,500 feet into the sky. "It looks like a science experiment gone awry," someone on the bus said. "A Buck Rogers rocket ship," someone else suggested. Paul and Gamay pretended to be impressed with everything they saw, but all they really cared about was the last leg of the journey, when the bus would drive through downtown Shanghai and right past the building that contained the American consulate. They were closing in on that block now, the traffic slowdown giving them a chance to study the surroundings. The view was less than enticing. "So much for the consulate," Gamay whispered. Paul nodded grimly. Scores of Chinese police and soldiers had been stationed around the building and at every intersection leading up to it. Barricades had been erected, and Chinese officials could be seen checking the passports of anyone seeking to be let through. All in the name of safety, no doubt. The bus came to another traffic light and stopped. As it idled there, Paul noticed another couple pointing out the security teams. He leaned toward them. "Any idea why all the soldiers are down here?" The couple turned his way. Based on the maple leaf pins they wore, he figured they were Canadian. "I heard something about terrorist threats on the news," the woman said. "It's just horrible, really. The police were at our hotel this morning, and I'm told they've surrounded the Canadian and British consulates as well. We're thinking we'd rather have gone somewhere else for our vacation. But now we can't even get home or meet our friends in Beijing because they've closed the airport and the train station." "I hadn't heard that," Paul admitted. "We're due to fly out tomorrow." She offered a kindly smile. "You'd better check with the airline, Sonny. I was told we might be stuck here for a week." Paul sighed as if it were a mere delay in the travel plans. "I guess I should," he said. "Might I use your phone? I'm afraid ours was stolen." Paul's overall impression of Canadian citizens was that they were always willing to help out, by far the most polite people he'd encountered in his travels. "Won't do you any good," the husband said. "They've shut down the cell phone networks citywide." "And the internet as well," the woman said. "It's like we're living in the Stone Age." "Or 1993, her husband said. Paul had to laugh at that. The Stone Age was not that far back, apparently. "Are the landlines still working?" "That's what we used," the Canadian woman said. "Called from the hotel." He thanked them for the information and sat down beside Gamay. "Guess what?" "I heard," she said. "Someone's pulling out all the stops." "Think all this is for us?" "Seems that way," he said. "With the whole city in an electronic deep freeze, we're going to have a problem getting this information out. We can't even use an internet cafe like we did in Cajamarca." Gamay didn't answer right away. She was staring straight ahead. "Not everything is frozen." She pointed to a small TV screen in the back of the seat. It was tuned to the international feed of CNN. A reporter was conducting a live broadcast, referencing the internet blackout and the terrorist danger. "The networks are still up," she said. "They have their own satellites, direct links to Washington and New York bureaus. If we could borrow one for just a minute..." She didn't need to finish. Paul knew what she was getting at. "It'll be risky. But I've never known a reporter who didn't want a world-class scoop. If we made enough big promises, we might find someone willing to help." "And if we could find a mobile truck," she added, "we wouldn't even have to set foot in a big, easy-to-surround building." Paul turned his eyes back to the reporter on the screen. "That shouldn't be too hard. Recognize the location."
"Should I?"
"We were just there 2 hours ago," Paul said. "That's the Oriental Pearl Tower in the background. Let's get off this bus and double back." They left the tour group at the next stop and took a cab directly to the tower. Arriving in the parking lot felt like hitting the jackpot. There were 7 different networks with trucks parked outside the soaring building, all using the famous backdrop for their shots. Paul and Gamay walked nonchalantly past the first two mobile trucks, eyeing the satellite dishes on the roofs with a type of excitement usually reserved for the arrival of a gourmet meal.
"These trucks are local networks," Gamay said,
noting the logos painted on the sides of the various vans.
"We need an American network. CNN or Fox or..."
Her voice trailed off. They'd come to a reporter, setting up for another shot.
"INN," she said. "Indie Network News. This is perfect. The whole network lives for conspiracy theories."
Paul smiled. "Since when do you watch that stuff?"
"It's my late-night guilty pleasure," she admitted. "That and Rocky Road ice cream."
"Explains all the empty cartons I find in the trash," he said. "Let's grab that reporter as soon as she finishes." They walked toward the reporter and her cameraman, careful to remain out of the shot. Gawking like tourists, they waited for the portable spotlight to shut off and the reporter to disconnect herself from the earpiece.
"Intercut the voiceover with a shot of those military helicopters that flew by earlier," she told him. "That'll make it more interesting."
"Sure thing," the cameraman said. As he got busy packing up equipment, the reporter moved toward the back of the mobile truck. Gamay intercepted her before she could climb inside.
"Miss Anderson," she called out. "Sorry to interrupt you, but I'm a huge fan. The documentary you did about what's really buried under the Hoover Dam was fascinating."
Melanie Anderson flashed a smile that almost hid the annoyance she felt.
"Thanks," she said, "though I hate to tell you, I've never been to Nevada. We used B-roll for the entire thing. But I'm glad you enjoyed it. It means we did our job."
There was a happy cynicism to her voice.
"Can I sign something or pose for a selfie?"
"A signature would be great," Gamay said, holding out a small pad of paper and a pen. The reporter took both items, raised the pen to the ready position, and then paused, as if she was thinking about what to write. Gamay had drafted a note on the pad, explaining who they were and that they needed help. The reporter looked up.
"Is this a joke? Did the guys at the network put you up to this?"
"I promise you," Gamay said, "it's anything but a joke. Can we please talk inside your truck?"
The reporter held her ground for a moment and then opened the door while calling out to the cameraman.
"Charlie, give me a minute, okay?"
The cameraman nodded, and Paul and Gamay followed the reporter inside. The back of the mobile broadcast van was designed much like the interior of an ambulance, except instead of medical equipment, the bay was filled with computers and production gear. It was cramped, but there were two small seats. The reporter took one and Gamay the other. Paul leaned against a cabinet, crouching to give himself just enough headroom.
"Let me get this straight," the reporter said. "You two are employees of a secret U.S. government agency, and you're being hunted by the Chinese. And this whole internet and phone blackout is to prevent you from contacting your bureau chief in Washington. Is that it?"
"Actually," Gamay said, "NUMA isn't a secret agency. It's very public."
"I've never heard of it," she said.
"We don't exactly advertise," Paul said.
"Okay, fine," the reporter said. "But the Chinese government wants you stopped at all costs, bringing Shanghai to a screeching halt if necessary."
"I know it sounds crazy," Gamay said. "Explains why you came to me," Ms. Anderson replied. "Crazy is my business. Fortunately, my producers come up with enough batty ideas to run three networks at least. We don't need any help from the public."
"This isn't a stunt or a game," Gamay reiterated. "We're not secret agents. We're not spies. I'm a marine biologist, and Paul is a geologist. We recorded video and sonar readings in Chinese waters that indicate a man-made, most likely Chinese-made, ecological disaster is underway. The Chinese government became aware of our actions after we arrived in Shanghai. They're looking for us and doing everything they can to keep us from getting this information back to Washington."
"That's all well and good," the reporter said. "But as I recall, the Chinese do whatever they want in their territorial waters, just like we do in ours. Why would they care if you found out about some industrial accident? What difference does it make? They could point to Exxon Valdez and the Deepwater Horizon and tell us to worry about our own yard before complaining about what's going on in theirs."
"Normally I'd agree with you," Gamay said. "But whatever they were trying to accomplish down there, They've caused a problem that's not just affecting the East China Sea, or the Chinese coastline, or even the Western Pacific. It's affecting the oceans all around the planet, raising sea levels in a very rapid manner. Forget global warming and its 1 or 2 per decade predictions. We're talking 10 feet per year, and the rate is accelerating. Low-lying islands are dealing with inundation from seawater already. Certain coastal areas will begin experiencing permanent flooding within 6 months. As Gamay spoke, Melanie Anderson seemed to perk up. "Worldwide flooding," she said, as if imagining a headline. "How bad will it get?" "We can't be certain," Gamay said, "especially if the Chinese prevent an investigation. But if you have any concept of how important the oceans are to food production, weather patterns, and even national stability, you'll understand that this could be the opening phase in a catastrophe of unrivaled proportions." "Unrivaled proportions," she said. "Not bad. You could have a future in the copy game." "Ms. Anderson," Gamay said. "Call me Mel." "I'm telling the truth," Gamay said. "Think about it. They've shut off the internet, shut off the phones, and surrounded every Western consulate in Shanghai with soldiers and police. They've even closed the train stations and airports. This isn't about keeping something out. It's about keeping something in. And that something is the information we have. At this point, you and your satellite dish are the only hope we have for getting this information back to America." Gamay was appealing to the hero. Paul took another tactic. "It's the story of a lifetime," he said. "Pulitzer Prize-winning material. And more importantly, a direct route to the big networks. You'll be hosting 2020 next year, not reporting on Bigfoot or alien abductions. You might even get your own show." She laughed. "Maybe, assuming you two aren't a couple of lunatics." "We have video and sonar data," Gamay said, taking the laptop from Paul and handing it over. "Judge for yourself." Chapter 32. Washington, D.C. Rudy Gunn arrived at the White House after being summoned out of the blue. The lack of information as to why suggested it wasn't going to be a pleasant visit. After a brief wait, he was ushered inside the Oval Office, where he stood respectfully until directed to sit. The president sat behind the big desk, reviewing something through a pair of antique reading glasses. Vice President Sandecker stood beside him. James Sandecker was normally a welcome sight for Rudy, since he'd run NUMA before accepting the offer to move to the second highest position in the American government. But Sandecker's face was stern, and Rudy felt no warmth from his old boss. The president pushed the paperwork aside, took his glasses off, and looked across the desk. "Rudy, you know how much respect I have for NUMA in general and your leadership in particular. So it pains me to ask you this, but what in the name of God are your people up to in Asia?" "Pardon me, Mr. President," Rudy said, "but I'm not exactly sure what you're referencing." "The State Department has been inundated with communiques suggesting your special projects team has been wreaking havoc in Japan. They've been seen dealing with local gangsters, accused of getting involved with an anti-government cult and burning down a 1,000-year-old castle. Now we're receiving intelligence out of China that all of Shanghai has gone into lockdown, and a massive dragnet has been spread across the city to locate 2 more wayward NUMA operatives who snuck into the country like spies." Rudy had been expecting heat to come down sooner or later. "They're not wayward, Mr. President. They're working on the sea level issue, following up leads which suggest China may be responsible for what we've seen globally. They appear to have violated Chinese sovereignty in their efforts." Rudy didn't blink. "I directed them to take whatever action was necessary in search of answers. I'll take responsibility." The president appeared cross. Sandecker offered a comment. "I told you Rudy wouldn't pass the buck. Don't cover for him, Jim. He doesn't need me to. He's telling it to you straight." The president turned to face Rudy once more.
Do you have any idea how delicate the situation is right now? How precarious Japanese-American relations are? China has been giving them the full court press for over a year to become part of an Asian-only trading bloc and military alliance. Things are changing fast. 9 months ago, they settled the dispute about war crimes from World War II. 6 months ago, they began treaty negotiations. 3 months ago, they held joint naval exercises for the first time ever. Tomorrow, they will sign an extensive cooperation agreement. And next week, the Japanese parliament will vote on whether or not to remain bound by the mutual defense treaty with America. I hardly see how that... The president cut him off. Any untoward actions blamed on America will just fuel the fire. The burning of the ancient temple has been played on nationalistic websites in Japan over and over for the last 72 hours. Rudy waited to make sure the president was done. Not much I can do about that, Mr. President. The castle was not burned by our people. It was, in fact, burned in an attempt to kill the occupants and the members of my team. We believe the kill order came from China. I see. As for the activities in Shanghai, Rudy added, my people are investigating something that could prove far more devastating than any political setback or realignment. The fact of the matter is, if this sea-level rise proceeds unchecked, switching political alliances and signing new treaties will be a bit like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. The president waved him off. I don't want to hear about the damned sea-level rise. I've heard it from Jim too many times already. In my opinion, you're both a little crazy. Yes, Mr. President, perhaps we are. The president stared at Rudy for a long moment, and then turned to Sandecker. You really handpicked a stubborn bunch over there at Numa. Sandecker grinned. Damned proud of it, too. We'll see what it gets us, the president said. In the meantime, Rudy, perhaps you can explain this. Without another word, the president aimed a remote control at the far wall. With the touch of a single button, a large panel slid backward, revealing a hidden high-definition monitor. A short video began. It displayed the murky view from an underwater camera. Along the side of the screen were various instrumental readings. It's our standard ROV interface, Rudy admitted. The video was jerky, spliced together in a hasty fashion. For 3 seconds they watched swirling water clouded with sediment. The next cut was a sonar image of what appeared to be a range of cone-shaped mountains along the seafloor. A close-up of one made it obvious that water was blasting from it like a geyser. Finally, they were treated to several shots of underwater wreckage, ending with a white, robotic arm and face. "Where did you get this?" Rudy asked. Sandecker answered. It was broadcast this morning by the Indy News Network without comment or explanation. They're claiming they were hacked, but, interestingly enough, the transmission was preceded by a series of numbers. String those numbers together, and you get the NUMA ID codes for Paul and Gemme Trout. You're lost agents in Shanghai, the president said. Yes, Mr. President. Sandecker spoke the thought already playing on Rudy's mind. You may have sacrificed them, Rudy. I hope it was worth it. They must have thought so, Rudy said, or they wouldn't have sent this out. It's up to us to figure out what it means. And to get Paul and Gamay out of there. We're not going to get them out, the president said. We're not even going to acknowledge their presence in the country. It'll be pretty hard to deny it if they get captured, Rudy said. He's got a point, Sandecker added. A look of frustration and anger crossed the president's face. You've put us in a difficult position. For that, I apologize, Rudy said. But it's in all of our interests to get Paul and Gamay out of there before the Chinese catch up to them. Not if it means throwing gas on the fire, the president said. Our best bet is to downplay the significance of this and make no moves whatsoever. If the Chinese think we don't care, they might stop caring themselves. Or they might bury Paul and Gamay in unmarked graves. A risk they took when they entered China. The president shut off the flat screen and closed the panel. That's all for now.
Rudy had spent enough time in the Navy that being curtly dismissed after getting reamed out was second nature. But that didn't lessen the sting. He stood.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Hang on, Rudy, Sandecker said. I'll walk you out. Rudy left the Oval Office with Sandecker at his side.
You know I wouldn't have sent them in without good reason, Rudy told his old mentor.
Sandecker moved with a quick stride, hands behind his back.
I've seen the briefing on the sea level rise. I'm aware of the urgency. The president is too, but his hands are tied politically. Until half of Florida is underwater, no one is going to see the need for action.
Rudy knew the game. He and Sandecker had always tried to rise above it.
I'd be violating the trust of the American people if I sat around and waited for that to happen.
Yes, you would, Sandecker said. So get what information you can out of this video and we'll see what we can do. With something more than murky pictures to go on, we might be able to act. At least we'd be able to bring the truth to light. Just determining that China is behind this would be a step in the right direction. But we need to know how they caused it, why, and how bad it's going to get.
Could we sneak a submarine in there for a more detailed look?
Not a chance, Sandecker said. The Chinese have doubled their patrols since Paul Ngame made this recording. We'd be risking a direct military confrontation if we violate their waters again.
And making the political situation worse, Rudy said. I understand.
They walked in silence the rest of the way to the foyer, where Rudy stopped and spoke his mind.
I'm not leaving them out there to die.
Sandecker didn't blink. I share your concern, Rudy. I brought Paul and Ngame on board, sent them out on their first assignments. But you have to accept reality. We may not have any choice in the matter. Rudy had spent a career leaning on the wisdom of James Sandecker. For the first time in his life, he found himself in utter disagreement with the Admiral.
I'm not leaving them.
Then you'd better find a way to get them back here, without making things worse.
Chapter 33 Nagasaki.
Kurt listened to the news about Paul Ngame calmly. Rudy Gunn was blunt as he delivered it. There was no hand-wringing or pronouncements of mea culpa from either of them. Nonetheless, both felt the weight of responsibility.
Can you get them home? Kurt asked.
I'm looking for an angle to exploit now, Rudy said. In the meantime, we've been analyzing the data. Even though the mounds in the video look like volcanoes, they're not. They're spewing nothing but water. No sulfur, no arsenic, no carbon. Nothing that you'd expect to find from volcanic action. Only hot, fresh water and minute amounts of trace elements.
How big are they? Joe asked. It's hard to tell from the video.
According to the sonar data, the closest one is the size of a 20-story building, Rudy said. We're less certain of the others, but they appear similar in scale.
How much water are they venting? Kurt asked. Enough to cause what we've seen?
Based on a three-dimensional study of the geyser closest to the camera and an estimate of the velocity and volume of the ejected water, we've calculated a discharge rate of nearly 500,000 cubic feet per minute. To put that in perspective, 10 of those jets are equal to Niagara Falls on a rainy day.
How many are there? Joe asked.
We don't know. Rudy admitted. In the snippet of video Paul Ngame sent, we counted about 40, but the time index on the recording shows that they've edited the video. It was originally much longer.
Just giving us the highlights, Joe said.
Seems that way, Rudy admitted. We're pulling satellite data now, but the preliminary indication is a bulge of water forming in the East China Sea and flowing outward. It's wreaking havoc with the standard currents. Under normal conditions, a large northbound current enters the area between Taiwan and Okinawa. That current has been deflected nearly due east and replaced with an outflow heading southward. The combined effect has unsettled the normal weather patterns, bringing fog to normally clear areas, storms to normally dry areas, and early snow over parts of China. Outflows to the north are so large we're detecting salinity and temperature changes all the way up to the Bering Strait. The Sea of Japan is being desalinized so rapidly. In another month or two, it will be little more than a freshwater lake. Where is all this water coming from?
We're trying to figure that out now, Rudy said. But to come up with any real answer, not to mention any hope of stopping this, or at least estimating how bad it will get, we need to know exactly what the Chinese were doing down there.
Which brings me to my next question. Are you making any progress?
Kurt explained the convoluted path they'd taken to get to Walter Hahn, and the fact that he'd been unable to shake the man with a direct face-to-face confrontation. We don't have anything on him other than the word of a Yakuza underling trying to keep himself alive.
You may have more than you think, Rudy said. I'm looking through your report now. It says here that his company designs and manufactures robots.
That's right, Kurt said.
I'm sending you a still shot from the video Paul and Gamé managed to transmit.
Kurt glanced at the computer screen and waited. The link appeared and he clicked on it. There, in black and white, was the robotic arm, shoulder, and cranium that the Remora's cameras had recorded.
Look familiar? Rudy asked.
Very familiar, Kurt said. Apparently, Joe's future wife has a twin.
Had a twin, Rudy corrected. That robot is buried at the bottom of a canyon near the anomalies Paul and Gamé discovered.
What was it doing down there?
It appears they were doing some deep water mining. There's a great deal of additional wreckage down there, including a habitat that was crushed like a tin can.
Any idea what they were digging for? Joe asked.
Afraid not. But whatever it was, it had to be valuable. Our own experience proves that underwater mining is usually 50 to 100 times as costly as ground-based extraction. In other words, even if they found a motherload of platinum and gold down there, they'd be better off just leaving it there. It would cost more to pull out than it would be worth owning.
Then it has to be something worth more than gold.
The geology department is looking into it, Rudy said. But right now, they're stumped. There's nothing they can come up with that would be worth the effort.
Something tells me the Chinese came to the same conclusion, Joe said. The place looks abandoned.
That's true, Rudy said. Nothing on the video suggests an effort to rebuild.
Kurt sat back. Something didn't add up. He turned to Akiko. When did Kenzo first discover the Z-waves and the tremors?
Almost a year ago, she said, confirming what Kurt already knew.
He turned his attention back to Rudy. You've got faster internet than we do, Rudy. Do us a favor. Look up CNR and find out when they incorporated. There was a brief delay before Rudy came back with the answer.
The partnership was announced 11 months ago.
Kurt nodded. And when did China suddenly reach out to Japan and start thawing out relations?
Also 11 months ago, Rudy said. In fact, the initial contacts coincide with CNR's incorporation to the day.
Kurt could see the outline of the answer, even if he couldn't see what was at its center. The Chinese wouldn't go through all this trouble to cover up an abandoned mine or to save face from an operation that went awry. They're hiding the truth because it's an ongoing operation, one that has shifted from the bottom of the sea to the islands of Japan.
That's a big leap, Rudy said.
I don't think so, Kurt said. All the actors are here. Han and his robots, the Chinese diplomats. A warming trend in diplomatic relations between the two countries that's proceeding at the pace of a bullet train. All pushed by the Chinese side after 7 decades of demanding apologies and reparations for Japanese aggression in World War II.
What are you suggesting? Joe asked.
Whatever they were looking for in that underwater canyon, they now believe they can find here, in Japan, or in Japanese waters.
Han is an extension of the Chinese state. The warming trend is a cover under which to operate. CNR is the tool to be used when they find what they're looking for.
Which is?
Impossible to know, Kurt admitted. I'll give your theory to the geology team, Rudy promised. Maybe they can round up a few possibilities. My primary concerns are getting Paul and Gamé back
and figuring out what the Chinese stumbled onto down there and how to stop the flooding. And our only hope of achieving either goal is by putting the screws to Walter Hahn.
Understood, Kurt said. I don't care if our hides get hung out to dry, Rudy added. I want you to find out what he's up to, even if you have to break into that factory and abduct him with your bare hands.
I don't think you'll have to go to such extremes, Akiko announced.
Kurt turned. She had his phone in hand. A text was flashing on the screen.
A message just popped up, she explained. Walter Hahn is inviting you to dinner.
Chapter 34.
It's a trap, Joe said. You know that, right?
Of course it's a trap.
But that's a good sign. It means we've shaken Hahn more than I thought, and it's worth the risk for a good look at the inside of that factory.
He's not going to show you anything incriminating, Joe pointed out, but he might teach you a painful lesson once he has you behind closed doors.
That's a risk I'll have to take, Kurt said. Besides, it would be rude to turn down his invitation after I pressed him for a meeting and insisted it would need to happen tonight.
Rude, yes, but also wise. Some might even say prudent.
Kurt laughed. Since when has prudence been our strong suit?
Joe smiled at that, but Akiko looked on with concern.
I can't believe you two are joking like this. He'll probably try to kill you.
Kurt shook his head. He can hardly invite me to his brand new factory and then bump me off during the tour. At worst, I'd expect thinly veiled threats, some form of intimidation, and perhaps undercooked food. If he likes to catch flies with honey instead of vinegar, maybe he'll try to bribe me.
Accidents can happen, she insisted.
Which is why you and Joe are staying behind.
Now you've really lost it, Joe said. I'm not letting you walk into a trap by yourself.
I need someone out here to call for help if I get in trouble, Kurt said. There's a spot on the hillside that overlooks the factory grounds. You won't be able to see inside, but you can watch for trouble and dial 911 if I miss my curfew.
Joe frowned.
So I sit around while you have all the fun.
I should go with you, Akiko said. My job was to protect Kenzo. Now I feel a duty toward you.
Kurt smiled. I appreciate the offer, but I think I can handle this alone.
Really? She said. What if they start talking in Japanese or Chinese instead of English? Wouldn't you like to know what they're saying? They may be plotting against you or whispering secrets you'd never be able to decipher. I could listen to them and watch your back at the same time.
The lady has a point, Joe said.
Akiko continued her lobbying. I'm very good at distracting men, should you need me to. And if it comes to a fight, you know I can hold my own.
Kurt nodded. Of that I have no doubt. He didn't expect combat, but the language barrier was undeniable. At the very least, bringing Akiko along would give Hahn one more thing to think about.
You've convinced me, but we're going to need proper attire. After a trip to one of Nagasaki's designer shops, Kurt and Akiko were properly dressed, and Numa's bank account several thousand dollars lighter. Kurt wore a double-breasted dinner jacket and an ivory-colored shirt with French cuffs. Akiko sat beside him in a shimmering gray dress, intricately embroidered with a beaded flower pattern. Her neckline continued off both shoulders, with sleeves falling gracefully past her wrists.
I've never owned a dress like this, Akiko said.
You look stunning, Kurt noted.
It's rather uncomfortable.
Kurt laughed to himself.
Something tells me comfort isn't the guiding principle.
Leaving the Skyline GTR behind with Joe, they traveled to the factory in a rented sedan. They pulled onto the grounds and parked beneath an overhead light 70 feet from the front door. With the crowds gone and the parking lot empty, the place felt abandoned. Just before getting out of the car, Akiko took a thin knife made of carbon fiber from her purse. It looked like a letter opener with a serrated edge. She slid it carefully up one of the sleeves.
I like to be prepared, she said. You should carry something as well.
Kurt held up a metallic writing utensil. I've always believed the pen was mightier than the sword.
You were misinformed, she insisted. All I have to do is twist the top, and this one will transmit everything they say and do back to Joe.
A secret gadget from your government.
Actually, I picked this up from an electronics shop down the street while your dress was being altered. 2,000 yen. Less than $20 at the current exchange rate. Kurt twisted the top.
We're on site, amigo. You reading us?
Joe's reply came through the car speakers. I have an unobstructed view, he said. I'll keep an eye on the car while you two are inside. Try not to have too much fun without me.
Do our best, Kurt said.
Kurt twisted the pen's top and the link was broken. He and Akiko got out of the car, locked it, and walked toward the front door. A security guard met them and led them into the building. Han met them on the factory floor.
I'm so glad you could find the time to meet us, Kurt said. This is Akiko, Numa's Japanese liaison officer.
Han bowed. His eyes lingered on her for a moment, and then he introduced his assistant.
This is Mr. Gao, my chief engineer.
Gao had a shaven head that reflected the lights in the ceiling. He wore plain slacks, a white button-down shirt, and bulky glasses on which Kurt saw tiny green icons flickering and vanishing. A wire led from the frame of his glasses to an earbud, and then to a power pack on his belt. The glasses were obviously a wearable computer, the flickering icons part of a heads-up display that only Gao could see and interpret. Dangling on a cord around his neck was a heavy medallion-type badge. It had several small buttons on either side, two blinking LEDs, and a meshed indentation that held a microphone and speaker. In his breast pocket were several pens, a flashlight, and a laser pointer. Strapped to his upper arm was another electronic device, perhaps a fitness monitor. Kurt couldn't be sure.
Akiko stared at him like he had the plague. He's almost an android, she whispered.
By the way he looked at you, he'd toss the electronics into a lake for a single kiss. Perhaps the lure of human touch is stronger than you think. With that said, Akiko's demeanor changed. She feigned interest in Gao with such expertise that it almost convinced Kurt. For the moment, they all made small talk.
Dinner is being prepared in our executive dining room, Han said. Perhaps you'd like a tour of the facility first.
I'd enjoy that very much, Kurt said. With Han leading the way, they walked across an expansive factory floor. Even though it was after normal working hours, dozens of machines were busy at work. Some were free to roam the factory floor, transporting parts from one section of the facility to another. Others were busy on a production line, welding and assembling components.
What exactly do you build here? Kurt asked.
Robotics for other factories.
Machines building other machines, Kurt said.
Automated procreation.
Not quite, Han said. The design and production work are done by human employees. But that will be automated one day, too.
Human employees, Akiko asked. Does that mean you consider the robots employees also?
It's a figure of speech, Han insisted. The truth is, robots liberate humanity from the most mundane and dangerous professions.
Most tasks performed by machines are ones you wouldn't want to do. Turning the same 5 screws and making the same 10 welds 100 times a day, every day of your life. Chiseling rock from the walls of dark tunnels in dangerous subterranean mines, where temperatures border on the limits of human tolerance and fatal accidents are common. I even have machines that will take a bullet instead of requiring a brave policeman or soldier to enter the line of fire.
Robotic soldiers? Kurt asked.
Of a sort, Han replied.
Show me.
He took them across the factory floor to an even larger open space that spread out below them like the floor of a massive convention hall. Walking onto a bridge that crossed the entire length of the room, they observed mock-ups and testing areas. The vast amount of high-tech equipment was staggering. There were flickering screens everywhere, machines, small and large, performing various tasks. Stopping above one walled-in area, they looked down on the mock-up of an apartment building, sans roof.
Begin the demonstration, Han said.
Gao pulled the device from his armband and tapped the screen a few times. Lights came up, and the situation below was illuminated. A dozen mannequins were placed here and there. Some hiding, others out in the open. A human employee stood in the middle of it.
A standard hostage situation, Hans said. 8 terrorists, 7 hostages.
The front door to the building was smashed down by a small battering ram machine on tracks. It pushed its way inside, taking fire from several of the armed terrorist mannequins. Sparks flew as bullets hit the armor plating.
Live ammo? Kurt asked.
Of course, Hans said. Limited powder at this point. We don't want ricochets killing anyone.
What about your employee down there? Kurt asked. How do the machines know not to shoot him?
He's wearing an identifier around his neck, Hans said. It tells the robots not to shoot him. Similar tools can be used on joint human and robotic assaults. Use of robotics will reduce friendly fire deaths by 95%.
Impressive, Kurt said.
Down below, other machines with weapons pushed in behind the battering ram robot. Instead of wheels, they had 6 legs, and they clambered up and over every obstacle with ease. They rapidly targeted and silenced the first wave of terrorists and pushed deeper into the building. They find their targets using a combination of heat sensors, sound waves, and cameras, Hans said. They communicate with one another as well. What one of them knows, all of them know.
The advancing machines paused, scanned the thermal output through the walls of the next room, and broke into it. A quick gunfight ended moments later.
And just like that, Hans said, the terrorists are dead and the hostages are rescued. Not one of them has been hit.
Kurt was impressed. How do the machines differentiate between terrorists and hostages?
We call it a discriminator function, Hans said. A combination of facial recognition patterns conforming to the known captives, heat sensors, and a weapon recognition program that allows the processor to determine which humans are holding guns and which aren't.
Ingenious.
And the ones that are damaged can be repaired or replaced. No one has to cry over a ruined machine.
A terminal beside them printed out a battle report. Hahn interpreted it.
21 shell hits on various robots. 2 machines sustained minor damage. A comparable effort using human policemen or soldiers would have resulted in the death of several personnel and at least half the hostages. The facts are unassailable.
Unlike the terrorist stronghold, Kurt joked.
Warbots like these will spare soldiers the most dangerous tasks in the field, Hans said.
Warbots?
A catchy name, is it not?
But this is a police demonstration, Kurt pointed out.
Yes, Hans said. But ultimately, armies of machines will take the fight to the world's most dangerous areas. They're more rugged, more lethal, and more dependable. They can fight 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, without the need for sleep, food, or medical attention. They will reduce human death and collateral damage, eliminate decades of post-combat suffering by wounded and traumatized soldiers and their families.
They will cause death on the other side, of course.
Not true, Hans said. Not only are robots more accurate, thus limiting collateral damage, they are more humane. A robot has no feelings. It won't take revenge on captives that might have destroyed its comrades. It won't lose its mind at the horror of war and start killing indiscriminately. A robot will not rape or torture its captives, nor steal or plunder.
Kurt nodded. He'd heard the arguments on both sides. Some were afraid that robotic soldiers would go out of control. Others pointed out that human soldiers were prone to emotion and strain and subject to losing control themselves. Like most things, no one would know the truth until it arrived.
They moved on, coming to an overlook. On the floor down below, a slew of machines were building a section of highway. One machine used a jackhammer to break up concrete. Another machine scooped it up and lifted it into a driverless truck, which, making a tight 3-point turn without hitting anything, then hauled it away, disappearing through a door at the far end of the convention hall.
While robotic armies might be decades off, Hahn began, self-driving vehicles are right around the corner.
We have them already, Kurt said.
A few,
Han admitted. But the next wave goes far beyond what exists today. CNR has even developed a driverless race car. It will compete with the greatest racers in the world and outclass them with ease.
Remotely guided? Kurt asked.
Han shook his head. The vehicle is autonomous. It operates completely without assistance, making its own judgments and decisions.
Driving around city streets is fine, Kurt said, but navigating a track at high speeds to the limits of a car's ability is another thing altogether. I've raced a few cars myself. Trust me, it's a far more dangerous proposition.
Han's reply came quickly. I assure you, Mr. Austin, despite your fervent desire to remain at the top of the food chain, robots with artificial intelligence are now becoming superior to humans in every task imaginable. They will soon fly our fighter jets, captain our ships, salvage wrecks from the bottom of the sea, and yes, even race our cars. And they will do all things in superior fashion.
Kurt listened politely, but he was more interested in watching Han. The reply had come so quickly, and with it a slight edge. The man had been cool as ice until Kurt questioned his machines. The rapid-fire response, a slight flare of nostrils, and a deepening of the crow's feet around Han's eyes confirmed it for Kurt. He'd finally found a button to push, and he pushed it no end.
I'm sure you'll get there someday, he said in a condescending tone, but we'll both be old men before a robot can beat a human on the racetrack. Machines can do many things, but they will always lack judgment.
Han held his tongue for a second, and then grinned. Care to test that theory?
I'd love to, Kurt said. What are you suggesting?
We have a track here on the factory grounds, Han said. And in the garage, we have the prototype of the robot car, along with two others still fitted out for human drivers. If you're willing to test yourself against it, we could even wager on the outcome to make it interesting.
I'd jump at the chance, Kurt said. But you're a billionaire and I'm a humble government servant on a fixed income. We'd have to bet something other than money.
Han grinned. If you win, CNR will gladly provide whatever robotic vehicles you may find useful for your expedition.
And if I lose?
Simple, Han said. All you need to do is admit that the machine is better than the man.
Chapter 35 Kurt had been expecting high-end sports cars tuned for the track, with roll cages built onto them, racing tires, and anything unnecessary pulled from the frame to reduce the weight. Stepping into Han's garage, he discovered three vehicles that were far more exotic.
These are Toyotas, Han said, though you won't find them at your local dealership.
Something tells me I couldn't afford them if I did, Kurt said.
Probably not,
Han agreed. This car was an alternate to race at Le Mans last year. Its twin-turbocharged V6 makes 968 horsepower, but we've tuned it back to a mere 700 for our purposes.
I suppose that'll be enough.
Kurt walked toward the gleaming orange and white machine. The car itself was a work of engineering art. The front end of the car had a lethal look to it, a pointed nose connected by carbon fiber panels to two swooping fenders that curved over the top of the performance tires and then dropped down behind them like a passing wave. A teardrop-shaped cockpit rested snugly in the center. The front was a graceful curving windshield that gave a near-panoramic view forward, while the tail end held a massive wing and three vertical fins that helped stabilize the car.
If I didn't know better, I'd swear this thing could fly.
Get it out of shape, and it will, Han warned.
I'll be careful, Kurt promised. 30 minutes later, Kurt had changed into racing gear and strapped himself into the driver's seat. Dressed in a flame-retardant suit with a 5-point harness and a helmet pulled down tightly over his head, Kurt was ready for the battle. The cockpit was snug, a tight fit for someone of Kurt's size. It surrounded him in billeted aluminum and a padded roll cage. Several easy-to-reach toggle switches sat on a platform to his left.
The steering wheel was removable and seemed positively tiny in Kurt's hands. The twin-turbo V6 shook the car as Kurt revved it. While Han's assistant readied the automated race car, Kurt got used to the controls. The pedals were so close together in the footwell, he could press both with one foot if he wanted to. Useful in certain maneuvers, but not something he wanted to do accidentally. The paddle shifter was easy to reach and simple to operate. He flipped a switch, and the four powerful headlights lit up the track in front of him, revealing black macadam lined with alternating orange and white rumble strips. "The robot knows the track," Han told him. "To make it fair, I'll give you 5 laps to get used to it yourself. Take the car out. Work it up to speed. Try not to put it in the wall or into Nagasaki Bay. Turn 5 at the far end is notoriously dangerous. It's off camber, so you'll lose adhesion there. If you hit the fence, the car will flip, and you'll be lucky to survive the impact." Han reached inside the car and flicked 2 additional switches. "This turns on the telemetry," he said, "and this one will activate the navigation guidance alerts."
"Guidance?"
"Similar to your phone, although far more accurate," Han said. "It'll tell you which turns are coming up and how sharp they are, so you won't be surprised. Like having a navigator sitting by your side."
"That annoys me enough in regular traffic," Kurt joked. "But I suppose I could use the help."
As Han backed away, one of the mechanics lowered the carbon fiber door and offered a thumbs up. Kurt eased the car out onto the track and spent the first 2 laps getting used to the layout, the navigator, and the instant and precise feedback that came through the steering wheel. By the 3rd lap, he took the back straight at over 100 miles per hour, racing along the waterfront as the city lights glistened on Nagasaki Bay. He slowed considerably for turn 5, and yet as the track tilted to the right while turning to the left, the car still felt as if it was going to fly off the track and into the bay. He ran each of the next 2 laps at slightly higher speeds, and then pulled into the pits, ready to begin the race. He stopped 30 feet from where Han's people were readying a yellow and blue version of the car Kurt was in. The paint was different, and the CNR logo was plastered all over it, but aside from a few additional antennas, the cars were identical. Kurt popped the door open. Despite the cool night temperatures, it was already sweltering in the cockpit. He pulled his helmet off for some air. Akiko came up to him.
"Are you trying to be my hero?"
"Your hero?"
"Defending the cause of humanity in its epic battle against technology."
Kurt had to laugh. "I'd say yes, but in all honesty, I'm just trying to get our host off balance. Keep an eye on him while I'm out there."
She leaned in and gave him a kiss. "For luck."
The robot car roared to life, and once it was up and running, Han walked back over to Kurt.
"Are you ready?"
"As I'll ever be."
"Good," Han said. "We'll have to keep it short. There's a storm coming in, and we don't want either vehicle out on the track if it starts raining."
Kurt nodded. "Enjoy your ride," Han said. "First car across the finish line wins." Kurt pulled on his helmet, tightened the strap, and nodded. The doors were closed, and the cars lined up in a staggered formation, with Kurt 30 feet ahead. Staging lights on a pole at the side of the track went from red to amber, then amber, amber, and finally green. Kurt raced out of the pit quickly and worked the car rapidly through its paces. The staggered start allowed the 2 cars to get out of the pits without colliding at the narrow end of the lane. Moving faster than he had on the other laps, the first turn arrived quickly. "Right 70," the navigation system announced. Hitting the brakes hard, Kurt felt the rubber grab and his whole body slam against the straps of the racing harness. He worked the steering wheel in a constant state of adjustment, skirted the orange and white border of the track, and slammed the throttle down as he left the turn. The car jumped forward so deftly that Kurt was thrown back in his seat in a way he'd last felt when being launched off an aircraft carrier as a passenger in an FA-18 Hornet.
"Chicane left," the navigator told him.
Heavy on the brakes, and another sudden decrease in speed followed. Kurt worked the steering wheel hard to the left, then back to the right. This was the slowest portion of the track, followed by a short straight and another turn.
left 40. This turn was easy to navigate, and Kurt held his speed all the way through, though the car was sliding a bit before the end. Right 30. Kurt had considered the navigator to be a distraction during the practice laps, but now, pushing the car and his own